Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. At what age do young people become adults? And does that designation really mean anything if they depend as much on their parents for food, shelter, and emotional support as they did when they were children? Unquestionably, the economic downturn makes it tough for the current generation of young people to strike out on their own when they come of age. But psychologist and author Dr. Brad Sachs has seen that a growing number of young American adults seem to lack not just the money they need to live independently, but also the life skills and the motivation. He writes about it in his new book, Emptying the Nest, Launching Your Young Adult Towards Success and Self-Reliance. Brad, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
How do you define self-reliance for a young adult?
Self-reliance is something that varies, obviously, from person to person and from stage to stage, but ultimately self-reliance means that you can stand on your own two feet, both from a financial standpoint, also from an emotional standpoint. Doesn't mean that you can't turn to people that you care about and trust for support or assistance. We're all somewhat dependent on each other, but you want to be able to handle the responsibilities of adulthood self-sufficiently.
Now, when I was in my early 20s, it wasn't unheard of for someone to live with his or her parents, but it wasn't anything that anybody thought of as more than a temporary situation. People would do whatever it took to sort of gain that independence. What makes those things so different now in many families?
There's a lot of differences, and some of them are external. Some of those take place more within the family's dynamics. The external ones clearly are that the economy has changed significantly over this last generation. The amount of education and training that's necessary to get the kind of job that gives you financial self-reliance is far more extensive than it was a generation or two ago in this country. I mean, as recently probably as the 50s and 60s, with a high school diploma, you could get a very good job in industry, make a good enough living to own a house and get health insurance and raise a family. And those days where you can establish that kind of self-reliance with a high school diploma are long gone. And on the other side, there's family dynamics, I think, that sometimes inadvertently interfere with young adults having the resourcefulness and the capacity and the resilience to move forward with their lives.
Of course, parents these days tend to do a lot more for their kids from infancy on than a lot of parents of earlier generations. We're monitoring and very often managing everything they do, from their class schedules to extracurricular activities. How does that figure in?
Well, what it does is ultimately undercut the child's self-confidence and self-assuredness, which makes the achievement of self-reliance that much more difficult. With all of the involvement, and of course much of it is well-intentioned, what it's telling children is that we don't really believe in their capacity to manage or function on their own. And those issues come to roost at that threshold of young adulthood, when in fact the young adult does have to be able to function on his or her own. So much of what we do to try to monitor and supervise and stay in touch with our children actually undercuts the very need that they have to become more autonomous and independent.
Do we protect them too much from failure?
One of the major problems is that we protect them from failure, we protect them from disappointment, we rescue them from difficult situations, and you really only feel self-confident and self-assured if you know that you can handle disappointment and failure without collapsing in the face of it. And if we don't inoculate our children, give them workable doses of disappointment and failure, which of course is an inevitable part of everyone's life, if we don't give them those opportunities, they never really do feel secure despite our efforts to help them to feel secure.
So I take it, Brad, that part of the reason that we can do this nowadays as parents is that we tend to have fewer kids than our parents and grandparents had, so we've got more time for them. And very often, if you know, you have an intact family, both parents are working, there are more resources.
Yeah, smaller family size certainly makes a difference because, you know, there's fewer eggs in the basket, and so we invest more and more energy in that. There's lots of sociological and sort of demographic explanations for it, but obviously in some ways the pendulum has swung too far, such that it becomes harder and harder for the young adult to embark on the separation or liberation that's necessary, and harder for the parent to tolerate that, because the family is revolving on the axis of the child and all the things that he or she does, and that makes it harder for that emancipation to take place.
What about the kind of contact that we have with our young adult children these days? I was surprised a couple of years ago when I would speak to college professors and they would say it was really common for kids to be calling home daily.
Yes. In fact, I read a recent study showed they were interviewing students at Harvard, freshman students, and it suggested that over 50% of these freshman students were in daily phone contact with one or both of their parents. It might have been a text or it might have been an actual call. And it's really an extraordinary thing to think about, because this technological umbilical cord that we've built does actually make separation that much more difficult, because it's so easy through Skyping, through Facebook, through cell phones, through all these different networks we've built in place. It makes it very easy to remain entangled with each other and deprive the young adult of the capacity to have to manage things self-sufficiently.
Another rite of passage was the after-school job or the summer job. These days, in middle-class families at least, they're often replaced by these enrichment activities. Can you talk about the effect of that?
Yeah, the enrichment activities obviously are useful, and parents really want the best for their children, and they want to give their son or daughter every edge possible. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is because there's been this growing gap between the rich and the poor in this country, and less of a middle ground. And as that chasm grows, parents naturally get very nervous, because if their children aren't on the top, they feel like they're going to be at the bottom. And so they provide them with a lot of activities that might build this skill or might build that capacity, or perhaps help them eventually get into a college of their choice or perhaps an elite university. But the problem is that those activities don't encourage the sort of responsibility and the capacity to manage on one's own that are really necessary for self-reliance to take place.
Yeah, you know, that's really an interesting point, because even though it doesn't seem like we're learning much when we're flipping burgers or washing cars, we're learning about the world.
Yes, there may not be tremendous financial value in flipping the burgers, but you learn a lot about values, and that becomes very valuable when it comes to moving ahead with your life and learning how to work with other people and learning how to fulfill orders and requests from other people, whether it's your employer or whether it's a customer. And again, there's tremendous focus right now on, you know, youth being leaders and teaching them good leadership skills. But in reality, most of us have to spend a lot of our life following, not leading. And those jobs that we have to get that are sometimes unpleasant or arduous in adolescence or early adulthood, they teach us the importance of being able to follow in a respectful, dignified way. And there's not enough of that. That's why so many young adults, they come out of college refusing this job or turning down that job, because it's not the perfect job. They've been led to believe and deluded into thinking that everything should just go smoothly from day one.
The other thing that it seems like a lot of young adults have a hard time with these days is the fact that when they move out of mom and dad's house, their standard of living will in most cases be considerably lower than it was when they were being supported by the family.
Yeah, many parents have tried extremely hard to create, you know, very warm, very nurturing, and at times indulging and coddling households. And one thing that does, of course, is diminish the young adult's motivation to move out, because he or she is never going to have that kind of life, certainly not for the first few years of their life outside of the house. And it becomes difficult to replicate or duplicate that standard of living. All of the things that they've been doing or granted, whether it was the cell phone plan or the car insurance or having money for $5 lattes, those things evaporate very quickly when you're living on your own. And it makes it harder then to cross that threshold and easier to return to the safety of the family fold.
What do you hear, Brad, from parents who have struggled with this? Why have they given their kids this much? Do they say, you know, I don't want them to have to long for what I didn't have?
There's always a desire to compensate for what we didn't have. There's always a desire on a parent's part to create the best possible life for the child. And again, I think these motives and these initiatives behind it for parents, I think they're very positive and very loving and authentic ones. I don't think they're nefarious. I don't think any parent is actively looking to undercut his or her child's autonomy. But the problem is that over time, they really begin to backfire. And the child's capacity to have self-confidence and trust in his or her own capacity to manage really gets eroded when parents are constantly trying to dote on and protect the child from responsibility.
Why do you think that we don't assume that our kids will sort of muddle through the way we did and turn out just fine?
I think that varies from family to family. You know, sometimes the child might have some sort of inadequacy or some sort of insufficiency, which really does convince the parents that, you know, maybe this son or this daughter of mine is not really going to be able to make it on his or her own. I think that's one of the great disadvantages in our culture of pathologizing and diagnosing everything, because we have so narrowed the definition of what is normal. It's so restrictive right now that the slightest deviation or departure from that must be the sign of some disorder or diagnosis or disease. And so a child who is on the shy side is diagnosed with a social anxiety disorder, and a child who's on the active or restless side has an attention deficit disorder. And labels of those sorts sometimes have advantages, but they seem to create more problems than they solve, because then the parent doesn't feel like he or she, as a parent, can trust the child to move on. And the child, too, starts to feel convinced that he or she isn't capable of autonomy because of this particular disease or this particular disorder. And what it does is, as I said, medicalize or pathologize every little quirk or idiosyncrasy and ultimately erode the child's capacity to feel confident and self-assured.
There's also that question of sort of interparental peer pressure. You know, my kids are not yet young adults, but their schools now have these programs where you can sign up online and look at their grades the moment they're filed. And I have mixed feelings about it, because on the one hand, I think it's, you know, it's my children's responsibility to bring to me the grades they receive and to be aware of this. But then if all the other parents are checking, you feel remiss if you're not doing it.
Yeah, nobody wants to put the gun down first. I think that's the problem with these situations. And you're absolutely right. I have very mixed feelings about these technologies as well. You know, on the one hand, you know, you want to be on top of things. But honestly, I have parents of seniors in high school coming to me saying, you know, they read online that their son missed this Spanish assignment or their daughter didn't do well on that test. And I'm thinking, boy, by 17 or 18 years old, if you're still having to provide that surveillance, that's not saying much about your trust in your young adult's capacity to function independently.
Do you feel the same way about the cell phone? I guess they're almost like tracking devices now that people can monitor where their kids are at all times.
Yeah, I mean, safety's a big concern for every parent. But as I said, the price we pay for the constant monitoring and constant supervision and constant surveillance is we're sending messages to our children that they cannot manage on their own, and then we seem mystified and bewildered when they're not taking the steps necessary to separate, individuate, and move on. But in reality, much of what we've been doing has been convincing them that they're just not capable of it. So no wonder they feel ambivalent or confused or uncertain as they're facing this threshold and having to leap off the cliff.
So, Brad, let's say that a young adult is, in fact, working but still living at home. There's always this question parents have, is it wrong to ask them to chip in for food and rent or to at least pay for all of their own expenses? Can you talk about what you would recommend there?
Yeah, any young adult who's capable and healthy and certainly has finished high school, if they're living at home, they should be contributing in meaningful and concrete and substantial ways to the family's functioning. It doesn't mean, you know, that they can come and go as they please. It doesn't mean that they can have friends over till 3 a.m. If they're living at home, unless they're paying for that entire mortgage, they have to be contributing in some meaningful way. And much of the work that I do with families who are having trouble leveraging their young adult out of the house has to do with raising the water temperature a little bit, because, frankly, some of these arrangements that I hear about, I'm tempted to sign up for myself. I mean, cell phone is covered and food is covered and there's no rent and you get a car and car insurance. I'm thinking, why would I go anywhere in a situation like that?
Dr. Brad Sachs is my guest. He's a psychologist and author of the new book, Emptying the Nest, Launching Your Young Adult Toward Success and Self-Reliance. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Brad Sacks, Dr. Brad Sacks. His new book is called Emptying the Nest, Launching Your Young Adult Toward Success and Self-Reliance. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We should say, Brad, that you have dealt with families who have a really hard time sort of separating and moving on to their now adult roles in life. There are also families where young people feel like they're being pushed out maybe before it's time and before they're ready.
One of the designations I make in the book is I have three classifications of families, what I call centripetal families, centrifugal family, and mission impossible families. Centripetal families is what you were just describing, which is families in which it's very hard for the child to break out of the gravitational field and create his or her own orbit. But there are other situations, too, which I call centrifugal families, and that's where the child almost feels as if he or she is being exiled or ejected prematurely, that they're being asked to leave without feeling like they got all of the nutriments, all of the fuel necessary. And those young adults, too, will find ways to dig in their heels and remain at home or not move ahead in successful ways because they keep waiting for their fuel tank to fill up. And the parents sometimes have to learn to be a little bit more patient and a little bit more supportive as they provide those nutriments and those nutrients to the child.
Well, it does seem clear that you can't sort of start this transition when your child is a senior in high school. It has to begin gradually much sooner.
Yeah, I mean, I tell parents the process of separation and liberation, that begins at birth. I mean, that's the initial and the elemental separation. And everything that we do as parents really needs to be designed towards ushering them forward. Now, of course, how we promote separation for a five-month-old is different than a five-year-old, than different than a 15-year-old. But this is not something that you begin thinking about or considering just because your son or daughter has entered middle school or high school. This is something that goes all along because the autonomy that lies behind self-motivation, that autonomy begins early on when we do or don't teach children to be responsible for themselves, to handle the consequences of their behavior, to learn how to deal with failure or disappointment without feeling like they are failures because they've encountered it.
So the best thing we can do for them is make them eventually not need us anymore.
Yes, and that's what's so hard for parents is because we never feel more necessary, more relevant, more worthwhile than when we are day-to-day parents. And as an adult, then, it becomes very difficult to relinquish that because we feel a little bit less relevant. And it nudges us as adults a little bit more towards irrelevance and even towards mortality. And so a lot of the families that I'm working with are avoiding that grief-stricken stage of coming to terms with the fact that life moves on, and part of letting go entails having to come to terms with moving on with your life.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Dr. Brad Sacks is my guest. The new book is called Emptying the Nest, Launching Your Young Adult Toward Success and Self-Reliance. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I have a comment. You know, we get our identities early on from our parents, and as we grow, we can have, we can benefit from their wisdom. We can benefit from, financially. We can help them financially. Right now, there are many forces designed to break up the family. We should take our cues from Latin America, from Japan, and support our elders. And, this position of the doctor is very injurious to our society. People who are broken away from their families are easy to control, and I think we really need to take a second look at this.
Well, let's get a response for you. What do you think about that, Brad?
The importance of family continuity and the interconnectedness between the generations is absolutely essential to mental, emotional, and developmental health. And it is something that we have to pay attention to. One of the things that I notice when I work with families in which a young adult has returned home is that rarely does it have to do with being for the good of the family. Most young adults who are returning home after having left, they want to get their finances in order, or they're coming back with their tail between their legs and trying to prepare for another foray forward, when in reality, sometimes it should be to support the family because there's issues that need to be taken care of. And the other piece of it is there really isn't anything wrong with a multi-generational family. And in fact, multi-generational families really were the norm in our country up until fairly recently, and they're certainly the norm worldwide. So I'm not suggesting when I write this book that there's anything wrong with a multi-generational family, just that parents have to be versatile and flexible depending on the stage and the level of self-reliance that their son or daughter has achieved.
So you're not saying here cut them off when they turn 21 or whatever?
No, not at all. And the other thing, you know, you'd begun the interview with a good question, what is self-reliance? I work with plenty of young adults who live away from home who are very, very dependent emotionally and financially, and I work with plenty of young adults who live at home, reside at home, and yet are very emotionally and financially independent. So it's not just a simple matter of geography when we talk about separation. It has to do with living a life as a dignified, civilized, contributing member, responsible member of society.
One thing you write about here, and I think this is maybe something that all teenagers struggle with, you know, they'll say, I want to do what's right, but I can't stand my parents nagging me all the time. What does it take to help young people understand that their behavior occasionally will trigger that nagging?
One of the reasons that I do family work, I mean, I work with families and I have the family sitting with me conjointly, is because it's important that each generation understand their contribution to the current state of affairs. And so part of my work with adolescents and young adults is to help them understand you are acting in a way that's eliciting, that's provoking or engendering the very controlling behaviors that you complain about. And likewise, of course, I'll talk to the parents and point out that constantly playing that nagging role is actually undermining or undercutting the possibility of your son or daughter getting independent. And so both generations have to be responsible for and aware of the ways in which they contribute to whatever conflicted state of affairs exists.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Back to the phones now. We'll speak with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. Great conversation as usual, Chris.
Thanks.
My kids are both in college now, and occasionally I hear from them. My son is in Arizona this year and for a couple months now, and he asks me how to do things or tells me when he needs to do something, and I'll sometimes offer a suggestion, and it surprises me when he follows my advice because I put it out there as one of, you know, several options. When my kids were little, I wasn't a soccer mom. I mean, I was at home with them. I could have run all the time, but in my childhood, I had a lot of unstructured time, free time to be creative and to do what I wanted, and I wanted my kids to have that. I really think that was a huge benefit to them. I've seen friends doing the schedule with several events a week or even a day, and I can't imagine how kids learn to do anything independently that way.
Yeah, what do you think, Brad?
Well, Maggie, you're bringing up a very good point, and it's another facet of this. Because we do so much organizing and structuring of children's lives, and again, there's various reasons for this, some of them good and some of them not so good, what we do is deprive them of the capacity to learn how to structure and manage themselves, and so they're constantly looking for someone else to do something. I remember as a soccer coach being very distressed, I took over a team of 7 or 8 year olds once. And as I was coming up to the field, I saw that they were just sort of standing around waiting for me to show up rather than kicking a ball around and playing soccer. And it's almost like even by 7 years old, they had been trained to wait until an adult shows up and tells them or designates what they're supposed to do. So the amount of scheduling and structured activity, while at times enriching and while at times growth promoting, sometimes works against the ultimate objective, which is for a child to feel like he or she can function on his or her own. And we have to watch that tendency because it's difficult to let go of it. And like I said a moment ago, no one wants to put that gun down first. You don't want to have the only kid who's not on the neighborhood lacrosse team or not taking violin lessons. But nevertheless, unless they learn and develop confidence in their ability to create, discover, and initiate their own lives, they're going to have difficulties when it comes to this rite of passage.
What do you say to families where there's a concern that if a child is living away from home or given much more independence, he or she will start using drugs or there's been a problem with that in the past? There are certain situations where people feel like they have to monitor their kids to keep them from truly deadly harm.
If the child, or in this case, I guess the young adult, is not showing indications that he or she can manage on his or her own without digging some deep holes, then obviously the whole leave-taking, the whole departure idea does have to be revisited. But what I have noticed, and I write about this in some detail in the book, is that those problems rarely are occurring in a vacuum. And many, many times these problems, the drug abuse or the promiscuity or whatever the dreadful, worrisome symptom is really a symptom of a process. And that process has to do with the child never having been allowed to differentiate or distinguish him or herself in a meaningful or healthy way. And that's when kids become vulnerable to some of these bad or worrisome or health-endangering habits, is because they feel like they have no space, no separation, and their natural innate desire to become their own person is feeling like it's thwarted or squelched.
What does it take, Brad, for parents to stop feeling responsible for these people that they raised from the time that they literally couldn't live 6 hours without constant intervention to the time when, you know, they might lose a job, they might, you know, have a breakup, and they still have to manage on their own?
A couple of the chapters in the book address the need for the parent to begin to rediscover, reevaluate, and perhaps recreate his or her own life. And that's really the best way to do it. Instead of focusing exclusively on how our children are doing, as children move into adolescence and beyond and literally do not need the day-to-day caregiving that an infant or toddler or school-age child may need, that's when the parent has to begin reinvesting in him or herself and begin to condense and shrink the amount of parental involvement. And as parents do that, usually what they find is, A, they start to feel more enriched either individually or maritally, and B, it frees and emancipates their child to move ahead with their lives. Because so many of the kids that I work with who are reluctant to move ahead, they feel guilty about leaving home because for 18, 20 years, the entire family has revolved on the axis of what they do or what they don't do. And so naturally, they feel like they're abandoning their parents when they move on rather than giving them something to feel proud about.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Susan in Dallas. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment and maybe a question, I guess, regarding grandparents who are raising grandchildren. My husband and I are in our late 50s, and we have raised our first grandchild since she was born. She's now 11. And I know that I'm raising her quite differently than I raised my first three children in that generation. And, you know, my priorities are a little different. I know I'm much more calm and, you know, just have a different outlook. And I'm wondering if there's any literature out there or any comments on any difference in preparing children to, you know, for adulthood if they're being raised, you know, second time around by experienced parents.
I'm not sure of any specific research, but I think what your instincts are probably already telling you is, you know, having been around the block a few times with, you know, your first children, you don't have the same level of fretfulness or anxiety as you're dealing with a grandchild because of the experience you've had and because you've seen that most of the issues and concerns that parents understandably worry and get anxious about really are not all that much to worry about. And so what happens in a situation like that, as we were describing a moment ago, is because there's more relaxed dynamic between the parent and the child generations, it's easier for the child to maneuver and navigate him or herself forward. And so grandparenthood gives you a little bit of space because you've had this experience and because it's not your literal birth child, and may give you a certain flexibility that in turn provides that child with the maneuverability necessary to move ahead nicely.
Brad, does it tend to be any more or less challenging for young adults to move towards self-reliance, depending on whether they've been raised in a home with two parents or with a single parent?
What I've noticed, the most difficult aspect of there having been a separation or divorce, which sometimes works against the achievement of autonomy, is that one or both of the parents feel guilty about the separation or divorce. And then they instinctively want to compensate for that. And sometimes the way they compensate is not so great. They become a little extra indulgent or a little extra tolerant. And so the child then doesn't have to deal with some of the firmer limits or consequences that he or she might have had to deal with if the parents were unified or if the parents were not feeling guilty about a separation or divorce. And that's probably the biggest variable that I've seen. I don't know that there's any literal statistics about differences in self-reliance based on whether a child's grown up in a two-parent home or if there's been a separation or divorce. But certainly many of the families that I work with in which there's been a separation or divorce, if there is an issue of reluctance to move ahead, it has to do with the parents not holding the child accountable because they just feel so bad that the family had to undergo this transition.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Next, we'll speak with Monty in Fort Worth. Hey, Monty.
Hi, love the program. I've got a sophomore in high school, and I love the topic today because I'm just really worried every day about how's my child going to manage as an adult. And I heard something on the radio not long ago. I'll never forget it. I tell my son, and that is, you know, in the U.S. today, we do a poor job of preparing our kids for the real world, quote unquote. And then by the time they're out of college and have to find a job and then do get that job and suffer through the menial work that's often required when they get their first job, the U.S. does a fantastic job of kicking them in the fanny and teaching them what the real world is really like and having to work for a living. And I wonder sometimes, how are HR departments dealing with these millennials and the fact that they've been mollycoddled up through the end of their college years?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Brad?
It's certainly been a big challenge. I actually have one of my patients is an HR director, and she's been stunned by the number of parents of employees who are calling her with complaints about a health plan or an issue that's taken place at work. These are college graduates who are 21, 22, even older, and their parents are still going to bat for them. And I work with a lot of deans at colleges and universities, and they report the same thing. They have parents calling about a roommate situation, the kind of thing that really should be taken care of by the student. But I'm sure some of these parents are justifiably thinking, look, if I'm shelling out $50,000 of tuition for this school, I want to have some say in what happens with this roommate situation. So that sense of entitlement that results from this parental involvement does make it harder for young adults to handle the sort of routinized, quotidian, everyday activities that are really a necessary and sometimes boring part of life. And I think we have to do a slightly better job of preparing young adults for these realities so that they can make these transitions a little bit more smoothly.
Dr. Brad Sachs is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Emptying the Nest. Join us on the phone by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychologist and author Dr. Brad Sachs. His new book is called Emptying the Nest, Launching Your Young Adult Toward Success and Self-Reliance. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Brad, let's say that a parent listening realizes that it's time for his or her young adult to start sort of taking on responsibility for himself or herself. There's a right way to start having these conversations and a wrong way when, say, that child comes to you with the latest in a series of problems. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The communication techniques that we may have been utilizing with or without much success in childhood and even early adolescence have to be retailored and reconfigured to take into account that we're now dealing with a young adult. Because speaking to a young adult in a condescending, in a judgmental, in a patronizing way is going to obviously arouse their defensiveness and make them less permeable to the kinds of thoughts that we want to have. And so we want to make conversation more of a partnership between parent and young adult. And the other thing we need to do ultimately is to try to trigger some conversation within their own head. It's much more important that they start to begin to talk to themselves and sort things out and understand the basis for their ambivalence or their reluctance rather than they share it with us as the parents. And so we want to go about these conversations in ways that arouse their curiosity about why they do what they do, what they want to achieve, and how they're going to go about it. What they do or don't say to us as parents at this particular stage is less relevant than the interior conversation or dialogue they're having inside of themselves.
So if they come to you and say, I can't, you know, my cell phone bill is higher than I thought it would be, or I've crashed my car, instead of saying, well, here's what you ought to do, or here's how I'll fix it, you say, well, what do you plan to do about that?
Thrusting more responsibility onto their lap, making it clear that you're not going to leap in to make a decision in either direction, and putting them in the position of having to think this out, those are all of the agendas and initiatives that we want to promote in our conversations with them. And it's the spirit that you bring to that that's going to make the difference. That's what they're going to remember. My mother, my father, seems to have faith in my capacity to manage this dilemma. Maybe if she has faith in me or if he has faith in me, maybe I ought to have some faith in myself. If we leap into action, if we leap into decision-making, if we're critical or judgmental or even overly praiseworthy or euphoric, all that does is tell the young adult that we don't really believe in their capacity to think and sort things out independently.
Should we withhold offering advice if they ask for it?
Generally. I mean, it obviously depends on the situation. You know, certainly if they're directly asking for advice, the first thing is to get a clearer read on their mental landscape, what they've already been thinking, what they've already been considering, what they've already been deciding. But, yes, I think in many situations it is fair to say it's your life. I really can't possibly know what's best for you, and I ultimately believe in your capacity to make the right decision, and if it turns out to be the wrong decision, for that not to be the end of the world. We have to make it a much less brittle, dichotomous, all good or all bad existence, because when young adults feel that way, it makes them hesitant to make any decision, and that's one of the reasons they wind up marooned in their family, because they don't have confidence in their ability to deal with the bumps and bruises that are a part of life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Tala in Carrollton. Hi, Tala.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two quick questions. My first one was, I don't know if your guest has had any experience or knowledge as far as raising kids in different cultures. Because I know, like, with my parents, coming from another country, they've raised me different from most of my friends. Another quick question was, if you know, any input or anything as far as kids or parents raising kids with different age groups, you know, if there's 5 years in between or 10 years in between or whatnot.
Thanks for your call.
No problem.
Well, regarding the first issue, you are absolutely right to point out the fact that there are cultural differences. There's been a large increase in our culture, in the United States, for example, of young adults living at home in multi-generational households. But one of the reasons for that is because there have been a lot of immigrants who, as part of their culture, cultivate a multi-generational household. So like I said, it's not a success or a failure simply because it's a multi-generational household. And every culture does have distinct differences in terms of how they define self-reliance or how independence is going to be achieved. But the elemental drama of leaving home, becoming your own person, and creating your own existence, that also is a universal thing. And while it may differ from culture to culture in terms of how long people live at home or which generations take care of which generations, there's an essential psychological passage that has to take place, and every culture has to find unique ways to allow that passage to take place. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I've been seeing signs over this last decade in my work and my practice that we're not doing as good a job of that as we possibly could.
There's the question of age difference. There's also the question, you know, kids are just, they come into the world wired so differently. What do you say to families where one or more children has made this transition very successfully and one is having a really tough time breaking away?
It's difficult when you have more than one child because those comparisons are inevitable. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that siblings will sometimes do is they will find some way to be visible and to distinguish themselves, even if it works to their disadvantage. So if you have an older sibling who's a particularly scholarly child, that second or third child may feel like, well, if I become scholarly too, I'll never measure up to my older sibling, or I'll just be invisible in comparison because, after all, he or she did it first. So part of human development, and certainly part of child development, is the child finding a way to distinguish him or herself from the rest of the family in a way that works to his or her advantage rather than his or her disadvantage. And the problems that we run into, and certainly the problems that I see in my practice, usually have to do with that desire for differentiation, but it becomes misguided. The child can only think of distinguishing him or herself in a way that actually is maladaptive or dysfunctional. And we have to help them as parents, as educators, as clinicians, to see that there's ways for them to be their own person that still can be growth promoting and positive.
What do you say to parents who, maybe for emotional reasons more than anything, are really reluctant to let their kids go?
It depends on the reason. I write a lot in this book and in my previous books about grieving and how every stage of human development has grief attached to it because we have to close some doors to open other doors. And much of the work that I do with families who are struggling at this particular cusp developmentally, they're reluctant to grieve. They're reluctant to acknowledge that time is marching on. And they're working very, very hard to try to keep time standing still. It's like the entire family is in a state of suspended animation. And what grieving does is liberates us. Grieving is painful, but grieving allows us to let go of what we need to let go of so that we can move on to the next stage of life. And so many times, while parents will bring me a young adult concerned about his or her own development, I'm more concerned about the parents' lack of recognition of the grieving that they need to do, because that's what's keeping them from moving forward and from allowing their child to move forward.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Grand Prairie, and we'll speak with Joni. Hi, Joni.
Hi. My question is about children with differences, ADD, ADHD, et cetera.
Right.
How do you balance that child's overarching need for help with the desire to help them become independent?
Actually, that's a good question, and one of the next books that I'm writing has to do with those situations where there really are legitimate disabilities or disorders or some sort of unevenness that makes it difficult. But I do have to say that the ultimate framework is still the same thing. You know, parents will come to me and say, you know, I don't think that my daughter should be expected to do this or that because she has an attentional deficit disorder. And the reality is that it's not that she can't do things. It's just that it's harder for her to do things. And so we have to empathize with the fact that it's harder for this child to become independent or autonomous than she would like it to be or than we would like it to be for her. But nevertheless, we still have to let her know that we believe in her capacity to compensate for her weaknesses, and we all have weaknesses, and find ways to capitalize on her strengths and move forward. There was a teacher that I was working with recently, and she was telling me the student came into her classroom and said, I won't be able to work today. I didn't take my medication. And that tells you how extreme things have gotten, that it didn't occur to this child that she might have to work a little harder to focus because she didn't take her medication. For her, it was an all-or-nothing situation. If I don't have this medication, then I am unable and incapable of working. And I think that's a great disservice to children to suggest to them that there always has to be some external vector or intervention for them to be able to succeed. So we do have to acknowledge these differences. We do have to acknowledge that many children have weaknesses. All of us have some things that we're not that good at. But we don't want to use that as an excuse to abdicate responsibility and not capitalize on the strengths we do have to compensate.
Have we made the world seem too dangerous for our kids?
I do think that interferes as well, because when we create this very sort of a sense of the world as this terrifying, fearsome, perilous place, it takes a child who might be a little bit on the ambivalent side or the hesitant side to make it a lot less likely to move ahead. And so we constantly talk about all the terrible, dire things that can happen. And, of course, in an age where there's so much information available, these things can often become contagious emotionally or mentally and create a state of almost near hysteria. So, yes, the world is a dangerous place. It's unfortunate. Tragedies do occur, and the universe often seems to operate in a surprisingly random way. But to imagine that we can prevent catastrophes or disasters from happening, or to imagine that you shouldn't be able to move into the world and take your chances, I think that deprives a lot of young adults of a chance to move into their lives and discover something.
We haven't really talked here about privacy, but I would imagine that part of this process of letting go and allowing young adults to gain their autonomy is recognizing that as parents, we no longer have a right or a need to know every detail of their lives.
Yes, and that goes back to that sense of, as parents, you're being nudged towards the margin. You're becoming marginalized. You're becoming less relevant, less necessary. And parents fight that because we then have to contemplate unpleasant realities like oblivion or mortality, which we don't necessarily want to confront. We work very hard to avoid those things. And so, again, we will delude ourselves into thinking that with enough technology at our disposal, we'll be able to keep our fingers in every pie and keep our eyes on everything. We'll have our programmable GPSs that tell us where our children are every moment of the day, and we'll have technology from the school that enables us to see did they finish their assignment and what they get on the test. But that's all a collective way to deny the reality that people move on, time moves on, and that we have to begin to relinquish the belief that we can be that daily part of our children's lives.
And ultimately, this is good for them. I wonder if you can tell the story that you tell, in fact, in the beginning of your book, about you had a patient who really was a smart kid, but all he cared about was playing video games and playing electric guitar. And until he sort of got out on his own, he really didn't do much for himself.
Yeah, he was worrisome because the things that he was good at and passionate about were not the kind of things that are rewarded in middle school or high school. He loved video games. He liked electric guitar. And, of course, that didn't help him do a very good job with homework and with other academic tasks. But his parents did not give up on him, and they really supported him and realized that these are the two things that he was passionate about. And he eventually did leave home, and he bumped around for a good amount of time, but eventually connected with some other people. And the other people that he connected with, they all got involved in this endeavor that combined those two interests, one of which was electric guitar, one of which was video games, and they created something that everyone's heard of now, which is called Guitar Hero. So this is a perfect example of a young adult who really was not functioning in the way, the traditional, conventional way that everyone expected, and yet his parents did not give up on him and understood that those passions were going to carry him someplace important. And that's the ultimate trust and the ultimate faith that we can bring to our children.
As we wrap this up, Brad, I wonder if you can list a few of the things that can indicate to us that our kids are making progress toward independence.
You want to look at this along the different axes of their life, and we don't usually operate on all cylinders simultaneously. You know, we have this image. I sometimes have parents say, I don't want to put any pressure on my child. I just want him to do everything he does at 100%. And to me, that's kind of a burdensome way to live because I certainly don't do everything 100% all the time. I don't think any of us do. So you want to divide life up into these different axes, their social or relational axis, their academic axis if they're still in school, their professional or financial axis. And as long as you're seeing movement in the right direction, even if it's not the magnitude of movement that you would like to see, as long as it's in the right direction, it's an upward slope, that's usually a sign that development is going to carry this child forward. But it's not going to happen on every front, in every aspect of their lives, every moment of the day.
The new book by psychologist and author Dr. Brad Sachs is called Emptying the Nest, Launching Your Young Adult Toward Success and Self-Reliance. Brad, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
It was delightful for me as well, Chris. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.